don't know about you, Matthew Denby, but stock Aiken Waterman seem to be everywhere at the moment.
And we can't get enough of that. We just had a Saw special on music video show Rage here in Australia, plus the Channel 5 documentary ran here to good ratings, and the stage musical I Should Be So Lucky continues to tour around the UK, so good times.
And we're now heading towards the 40th anniversary of the release of the first ever Saw production, The Upstroke, which we launched this podcast with way back in episode one. So I think it's safe to say the Hit Factory is going to be getting even more attention in the coming months.
Yes, including from me, because I'm off to the UK very soon, and I'll be undertaking various Saw-related activities there, including seeing the musical. So keep an eye out and say hi if you recognise my face, or if you hear that familiar droning voice.
Now, as we have been for almost 3 years now, we're part of that continued focus on Saw. We have the final stage of our journey through their discography to complete. But before we dive into 1991, we wanted to share with you an interview from late last year with Ron McCrate from Sharp End. And Sharp End was the company that was responsible for plugging many of Saw's records and also handled publicity and promotion for a bunch of the artists that recorded at the Hit Factory. And it was a really crucial role that Sharp End played, wasn't it, Matt? After all, a record can be the best song ever made, but it might not be a hit if no one hears it.
Absolutely right. Pluggers can make the difference between a hit and a flop. And Ron is going to give us a really good understanding of how it all worked and how Sharp End came to be. A bit like Supreme Records, it's an entity that was very much tied in with the Saw story, as well as the business side of PWL. And plugging is very much more than just giving away free records. It's about winning over whatever channel will have you when the other doors are all closed, whether that be radio, TV, or the press, and getting the right kind of exposure for those releases.
So we're going to kick off with some background stuff on how Sharp End came together and how it was connected with PWL from the outset. Ron recently released a book called In at the Sharp End, in brackets, Stories from the Frontline of the Music Business. And in that, he goes into much more detail about his music industry pedigree, and it's worth checking out. And I love the way that the title is a Saw-friendly bracketed title.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to hear from Ron now about the artist who really got the ball rolling with Sharp End and took Saw to another level, Kylie Minogue. We're going to learn how it really started for Kylie in the UK with some info not a lot of people know about what could have been her first single there. Also, Ron will talk about how Kylie's big changes in 1990 affected the business and some of the key relationships at PWL.
Okay, that's a lot of exciting stuff to listen to. Let's dive in to the interview now. Some people are going to know what a plugger is, but I know some people aren't. I guess if we're thinking about the 80s, what in the 80s, what was a plugger doing?
A plugger, basically, their main job was to present records to, in our case, the major radio station. Then it was really all about Radio 1 and Capital Radio in London, to persuade the programmers, producers, or the DJs themselves to play their records. That's a plugger in simple terms. But Sharp End as a company, we decided up until this point, a plugger was kind of, it's almost like a dark art. It was kind of secondhand car salesman techniques and gimmicks and publicity stunt. And we thought, well, it's getting a bit more serious than that, because it wasn't just radio. The TV aspect of it was coming into play. But TV is a completely different ballgame, in as much as everything has to be really well organized. And we decided, if we set up a company that is really efficient, not only, yes, you've got to have the powers of persuasion, but also is very well organized and therefore can pitch to TV shows and gain the confidence of the producers of those shows, that we could deliver an artist fully choreographed, stage plans, camera scripts, wardrobe, hair, makeup, the full package super efficiently. People will turn up on time and do a great show for them. The timing for Sharp End was perfect, because suddenly there were any number of shows carrying music. So a plugger's job was not then just Radio 1 Capital, it was dealing with all the TV shows. It gave a plugger an opportunity to actually put together a proper campaign, as opposed to just take a single and take it to a radio station and just wing it.
I guess it spilled over into promotion and publicity.
Yeah, we had a press department. That all started really with Kylie, But you're right, it was the full package, because the idea would be when a record is finally released, the public couldn't get away from it. It was on the radio, it was on television, it was in the national press. Everywhere you go, you see Kylie Minogue, and that's what we, that's our job. We just thought there was an opportunity, if we could find the right client, to do this properly. Me and my then business partner, Robert Lemon, and Robert said, well, who do we know that got some decent records? Because most of the majors would work their records in-house. So we, well, what about Pete Waterman? And at that point, he'd done stuff with the Bell Stars, and Bananarama started, Hazel Dean. But I, for some reason, I couldn't really take Pete too seriously. I thought, getting a bit of luck here and there, but is this going to really be anything? So anyway, we met with Pete and his sort of manager, David Howes, who ran PWR Records. And Pete played us Never Gonna Give You Up. My God, this is probably the best pop record I've ever heard. And still to this day, it probably is. And of course, the whole Scott Aitken Waterman scenario gave us that opportunity, because they were just making the best pop records. And also, it wasn't just a record. It was a great artist like Kylie, for example, and Jason, visually stunning, great performers, TV friendly, nice people to work with. Those kind of artists offered us that opportunity to do a really good job.
And so then you and your business partner and Pete and David came to an arrangement.
Yep.
What was the arrangement that you agreed on?
Well, as I say, we would decided we'd form a company, a proper company. And when in that same meeting when he played us Rick Astley, Never Gonna Give You Up, you know, we were sort of pitching to him, saying, well, we want to be right at the sharp end of the music business. And of course, Pete, that's what we call the company, Sharp End. And as he was going to support us financially as well, he and David Howes became shareholders and directors. But for us, although we're giving away 50% of the company, it meant we got all the work. So everyone was happy.
So it was kind of being in-house without quite being in-house.
That's right, yeah. You know, we did have, because we wanted to be autonomous, so we did have our own offices really close to Radio 1, right in the centre of London, 5-minute walk to Capital Radio. And because, of course, in those days, we would, what would you call a service, a record which would then be on vinyl to those radio stations. Sometimes it's funny, like my kids used to say, it's a funny job you have. You give records away. That's what you do. Yes, but we're giving them away to the right people.
With the arrangement with PWL, you were obviously going to be plugging, promoting, etc., stuff on the PWL label, but you did also do other artists who worked with PWL who weren't necessarily on their label, Hazel That's Dean, right. who was EMI, and Sunita, who was Fanfare. So was that part of the arrangement, that you would get those other artists?
Well, sort of. Obviously, Pete and David being shareholders in Sharp End, it was in their interest as well. So if they produced a record, they would say to EMI or Fanfare, Simon Cowell, use Sharp End. And of course, they didn't mind that, because we were hot. You know, we were delivering every level. And indeed, Simon Cowell's a great example, because Simon would sort of hang out with us, because he was thinking, all I've got is really Sunita. And if I hang out with all these guys, it'll rub off on him, the success. It was the other way around when you think of it now. Simon, the demigod of pop music, well, he likes to think he is. But he was kind of struggling.
So they'd put the word in for you and say, okay, well, here's your Hazel Dean single, yeah. album, whatever, and yeah, Sharp End will plug it for you.
Exactly. And then obviously the record company would pay our fees. Same with Brother Beyond. They were on EMI. A lot of success there too.
When you started in 87 doing the PWL stuff, and we'll talk about some of the specific artists and songs in a minute, but in general, how difficult was it getting pop played on the radio at that point?
Very hard, because it was really all about Radio 1. And Radio 1 considered themselves at that point in the 80s to be a rock station more. It was Fleetwood Mac, the Eagles, the Rolling Stones. And it was hard to break through. And I remember most of the work was done in the pub by Radio 1. And I remember being in the pub with their head of the music, guy called Chris Lysett. And he said, why are you doing this pop stuff? It's nothing. It's nothing to us. So I said, yeah, look, Kylie Minogue, he's got everything. No, you will never hear Kylie Minogue on his radio station. And I go, okay, we will see. Let's just give it time. And a prime example of that was Radio 1 used to have these flagship road shows in the summer. It went around all the seaside resorts in the United Kingdom. And at the time, they would just go, well, the DJs are the stars, and we don't really need artists. And I said, can you imagine, by this time, we'd had a hit with Kylie. If we could get Kylie to the beach in, let's say, Plymouth, which is massively populated in the summer, on stage there, no entry fees, this would be a complete riot. And reluctantly, they said, let's do it. And we did it. And, of course, it put the whole Radio 1 roadshows on the map for the next 5 years. They were the biggest thing. Of course, but then it turned around completely, because then Radio 1 were coming to us saying, can we have Jason Donovan for the next road show? Can we have Sunita?
And they were playing them on air by then as well, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, the breakthrough, I guess, came with I Should Be So Lucky eventually, because to start with, it was TV driven, obviously, with the latest angle, but they had to kind of concede in the end, and it eventually went on to the Radio 1 playlist. And that was the big breakthrough for pop in general on Radio 1.
And that obviously was the start of 88. So all through 87, as Sharp End was starting up, I guess you would have been faced with this stumbling block of, yeah, but Radio 1 aren't going to play pop.
Exactly. And in fact, the first record we worked on for the label, PWL, was Mandy Smith. Mm. I Just Can't Wait. And then Boys and Girls. And I think maybe we just got a couple of plays, but it was almost impossible. But so again, with Mandy, it was all about the visuals, if you like. We worked that. It still wasn't successful in the UK, but she did well around Europe. Yeah, it was a stumbling block.
And with Mandy, was it just that it was pop, or did you feel like because of the backstory, was there also that playing into the resistance to Mandy? Because we've talked about her singles on the show and how they didn't perform in the UK, and doing the press angle and dealing with TV and radio, did you come across resistance to Mandy, the persona of Mandy and her story?
Yes, is the answer to that. Not with everybody. I think the pop press went for it because she looked so good, and she was a really nice girl, you know, so she did a really good interview. So we got quite a lot of press coverage. But in the end, it was a non-starter because there was this resistance. And it actually, when she finally married Bill Wyman, it was a great wedding. But I think her career basically was over at that point for us. It was impossible.
And how far in advance were you played tracks? I know, obviously, PWL worked very quickly. They'd mix a record and it'd be out on radio the next day or something. But like Rick, you obviously heard that sometime before it came out. And I know it took months for that to actually get released. But in general, were you given a song and, all right, here's the new such and such, here's the new Sonia record, go? It's all happening straight away? Or did you have, like, time to listen to it, and were you ever asked your opinion at all? Or
yeah, we were. I'm not sure if Pete ever listened to it, but yeah. Well, okay. We had a weekly meeting at PWL, which most of the time was a Monday morning, because by then we'd had the chart positions came out on Sunday evening, so we knew what we had to do to keep a record going or whatever. And then during that meeting, often Pete would play us the new Jason Donovan, or we've got this girl Sonia. Check this out. So we worked very closely with them. They finished a record midweek, so it had to wait till Monday for the next meeting. They'd bike over the cassette, so we heard it immediately. But most of the time, it wasn't a problem because we'd listen to the cassette immediately and go, wow, this is a hit. There's nothing to say other than, let's go. Yeah, we were very, very much part of it. And I remember Pete once, he played us Silver the Kiss, Jason Donovan, which he was very happy about. And, so what do you think? And we went, yeah, no problem with this. And went, do you think number one? I said, well, depends what else is around. You know, there could be a new Cliff Richard record or whatever, but yeah, potentially. And he said, well, the thing is, the new Ferrari's up for sale, and I want to feel confident that I can afford to buy it. so I need to know it's going to be a number one. And indeed, it was a number one. A happy ending to that one.
No pressure or anything.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Kylie. Now, in your book, you mentioned that there were maybe talks about the Australian version of Locomotion that Mike Duffy had produced out here, of that coming out in the UK. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, my memory of that was that David Howes, who was the big fan of Kylie, actually more than Pete, you know, he's checked this out. And we went, we kind of get her, but I'm not sure about this record. Again, it's still a problem to this day. Getting covers, new versions of a previous hit song played on the radio is difficult because the radio stations just revert to the original. That's their kind of position, default position. So that is a big negative. But then we found out that actually David and Pete had played that to other labels to try and get it licensed, and everyone passed. So I think Pete kind of lost heart of it. You know, we can't get this record released, so we'll move on to Rick Astley.
I think the impression always was that Pete mainly didn't like the version, but it sounds like they were at least trying to shop it around.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, and as I say, I think David Howes was the guy that was really keen to do something. But again, if everyone's passing on the record, you kind of have to move on. We have to think of something else here. But David wouldn't let go of the whole Kylie idea and therefore convinced Scott Aitken Waterman to make a record with it. But then one of our meetings, he said, oh, Kylie's coming next Monday. So we made a note, so maybe we'll better meet up with her and chat with her. But when it came to the day, Pete had forgotten. This is Kylie's arriving today. No, it's next week. No, I think you'll find it is today. A big embarrassment. So Pete disappeared. He didn't know quite what to do. So we took Kylie and her mother, Carol, and a guy from the Mushroom Records, Gary Ashley, was with her. So we just sort of did a bit of a sightseeing week going around London, and we used to take her to show her where Radio 1 was. One day you might be there. Capital Radio, one day you might be there. This is where Top of the Pop was done. One day you might be there. Because we wanted this record made. We knew we had a winner here with those guys doing it and Kylie. It was an obvious winner.
But it was all about TV in the UK with yeah. I Should Be So Lucky. So radio was still, even though it wasn't a cover, even though it was a brand new Stock Aitken Waterman record, they were still resistant to playing I Should Be So Lucky at first?
They were, totally, yeah. Again, there was no grudge against Stock Aitken Waterman, but Radio 1 just considered their kind of music was not right. As I said earlier, they considered themselves to be a cool rock station. So it was hopeless. But what we did as a promo company, we got in touch with the BBC publicity department about Neighbours and said, look, what's the story with Neighbours? And they said, well, this was probably in the October or something of 87. And they said, next year, January, she is the star. So that's your window. That was the opportunity. Therefore, the release was timed in with that. And as I said earlier, there were any number of mainly kids pop shows, Saturday morning TV. We had Going Live, which was BBC One, attracted a huge audience. And they were the first to play the video clip of I Should Be So Lucky. That had incredible impact. And it, in a way, it was all you needed. That was it.
So from then on, once Kylie had had that big hit and obviously the rest came in 88, Gotta Be Certain, Je Ne Sais Pas Pourquoi, The Locomotion, etc. Did it become a case of deciding what Kylie was going to do rather than trying to convince radio and TV? Like, did the power balance shift? Instead of you knocking on doors of, will you do something on Kylie? Can she come on the show? Can you play the record? It became them coming to you?
Yeah, oh, most definitely. Yeah, they got it pretty quickly, because then Gotta Be Certain is a great follow-up. And the doors by then were open because it just became so big, not just TV, but also the whole publicity campaign, the press side. She became a star, and Got to Be Certain went straight in the chart. And then Radio 1 think, you know, we better get on board this. They did. So the door was open from then on. And of course, the guys delivered great records every time. So it was irresistible. So our job was so much easier, but the job actually became more a question of how to let people down gently, because everyone wanted her. And of course, there was still limited time until she left Naples. In the early days, we didn't have a lot of time with her, but they were queuing up to book her. So it was a question of our PR exercise is how to keep everyone happy while they waited for their turn to have Kylie on their show. That became the job. Position of power in a way, but you can't let that go to your head.
Now, there's something in the book about the Sharp End team sitting around, possibly with Pete, trying to come up with stories to pitch to the press. Then you mentioned that after that, the press came up with their own stories.
Yeah.
Was part of the Sharp End job creating the narrative as well?
Yes.
Were they always true stories?
Yeah, they were. They were very innocent things. We had the Sun, national newspaper, had it. Well, it still do have it, the Bizarre column. And in those days, with no social media or anything, it was huge. So just a one-liner in the Bizarre column was just worth its weight in gold. So they were fairly, we didn't get big stories initially. It was just things like, what can we say about Kylie? And there was also the Daily Star and the Mirror, the other two biggest tabloids. And it could be simply Kylie Minogue is arriving in London next week or whatever. And a new single is I Should Be So Lucky. It would just be that simple. But of course, yeah, you're right. When it all took off, it was more a question of trying to keep her out of the press, because we didn't really need any negative stories. And there were, you know, Piers Morgan, he ran the Bizarre column, and typical journalist, he still does it now. Well, you know, you get a phone call, Cizay about Kylie being sick, she's not coming. Well, where did you get that from, dear? Oh, I had good resources in Melbourne. And I said, well, they're not very good resources, because it's just not true. And he'd go, can we quote you? I said, no, there's nothing to quote about. So we said, you can't print that, because it's just nonsense. So you're saying no comment. And I said, no, we're not saying no comment. We're saying no story. Very tricky to deal with that, because, and then it got worse later on when she hung out with Michael Hutchins. It was starting to get very difficult.
And especially with the relationship with Jason, and that was kept under wraps, except, you know, it was like the worst kept secret in show business. Yeah. But I guess that would have taken some management, I assume.
Yeah, well, it did. It was almost impossible, though, because everyone knew that Kylie and Jason said to us, look, you can't say anything. We don't want to be asked those questions. So we were in a good position to say to journalists and to TV people, let's talk about the music. Let's not talk about that. And they went along with it by and large. You know, I mean, some would push it a bit, but both Kylie and Jason were very good themselves at handling it. You know, like a good politician, don't actually answer the question.
Let's fast forward to 1990 with Kylie, when she sought creative control and got it. Better the Devil You Know was the big shift in visual image, and the sound was a lot clobbier. What did that mean for your side of things? Did she approach publicity differently as well, and promotion?
Not really. I think the power shift was only in part, because the records were still Stott Aitken Waterman and their song, their idea, their production. And for us, for a radio record, it was the same. The shift really came with the visuals, with the videos. And there was conflict there, because David Howells basically oversaw, you know, managed the video output. And David thought it was wrong. He just said, it's the kids' market and this is getting too much. But anyway, he lost that fight. Kylie won that, and basically she was doing her own video. But it worked, because in the end, I mean, it's nothing considering what you see now. It was very, very innocent. But for me, it was still about a great pop record. It didn't kind of matter. And I think it worked from the point of view Kylie was happier, because she thought she had at least wrestled some control out of the situation.
So, but in terms of promoting that and the image change, did that present any new challenges, or was it just kind of business as usual? I just look a bit different now.
Yeah, pretty much was business as usual. I can't remember any problems with the kids' TV show. I mean, there was a lovely lady called Kathy Gilby who produced Going Live and then later Live and Kicking. She was the kind of don of kids' TV. was pretty strict about this kind of, you know, censorship, if you like. But actually, she went along with it. And went, maybe because Kylie was so big that they kind of had to, you know, and again, they were great records. So there was enough going on there that she just said, oh, yeah, we'll show the video anyway. It'll be fine. And there was never any backlash to that. It actually ended up quite well. You know, no problem for us at all. And in fact, yeah, probably opened up other doors in other TVs.
That really shows, yet again, how essential David Howes was in driving the Kylie project in the UK. I loved hearing how Ron would drop stories about Kylie into the press and how even very basic information, like her being in town or releasing a single, would be enough to get major exposure in the papers at the time. Things have really changed a lot since then. These days, celebrity reps think nothing of selling their clients' private lives for exposure, often with some pretty creative stories, but not, it seems, back then. And of course, we heard all about Piers Morgan being Piers Morgan. Mm. Him and phone calls, eh?
Yeah, right. Now, in the full interview in the bonus content, of course, there's a full interview in the bonus content, you'll also hear Ron answer this question, which I asked because it related to something he talks about in his book. Did Terry really get banned from PWL?
Great stuff. So in part two of the interview, we're going to hear about Ron's experiences with a bunch of other Saw artists as the decade turned. We'll hear about Jason Donovan and what was behind his big career shift in 1990, as well as why the Reynolds girls really got his goat. Plus, our friend Sunita and, yes, good old Simon Cowell, who was lucky not to be finished off by a rather rash deal he made.
All right, let's go. Here's more of Ron. Jason went from having the highest selling album in the UK of 1989, 10 Good Reasons, to 1990, and it was hard to get his tracks into the top 10 and a few of them missed. What had changed?
Well, that's a very difficult question because Jason was always popular, everyone's friend, great to work with. It's hard to put your finger on why, but as a plugger, it's easy to blame the A&R department. But my personal opinion is that the records just weren't as good, the ones that didn't make it. Because if you look over time, the big hits still sound like they should have been big hits. And the failures, when you look back at them, think they weren't as good. Those records weren't as good. And that's why they failed. That's my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. But there was a thing where during our time with him, he then got the part in Joseph, which is a big deal. The transition that he made from just being a pop star, making videos to on stage every night at the London Palladium. He did so well. It was just fantastic. But I think that was a distraction, really, because he had that as an alternative and he had Andrew Lloyd Webber as an alternative, a bit different from Pete Waterman. So he kind of went that route, really. Again, it kind of faded away. And by then, Polydor had the soundtrack to, because of Andrew Lloyd Webber. They just took the whole thing over.
So it had things like Hang On To Your Love and Another Night. Rhythm of the Rain went top 10, but just. Ooh. Had they done what things like Sealed With A Kiss and Too Many Broken Hearts had done, do you think the PWR relationship would have lasted longer? But because it was already, the singles weren't doing as well, and now there was this new potential career that it was like, okay.
With the benefit of hindsight, yes, it had a couple more hits on PWR, right? Top five, it could have carried on. But, you know, for how long? Because everything, I mean, Kylie is an exception in every which way. Things have their natural life.
But I guess they pushed Kylie's sound in that same year. In 1990, she was doing Better Than You Know, Step Back in Time, What Do I Have to Do, and really pushing ahead with the music, whereas it did feel a bit like Jason's songs were not that much of a step away from what he'd previously been doing. Did you... getting the songs and trying to get radio play on the songs, did you feel like the songs weren't as exciting?
Yeah, it was a little bit like that. You're absolutely right. It was a bit sort of same old, but not quite as good. So it became harder. But as I remember, he was such a big star that and by then Radio 1 were on board with pop big time. So we could still get the airplay. But the proof is people are hearing the record, but they weren't buying it. But that's the evidence, if you like. He's my time boy, what happened with Sunita is she'd have one hit, which was the first one was So Macho, mm-hmm. but they were struggling to find a follow-up. And by then, there was this sort of relationship between Saeed Morton and ourselves and Simon Cowell. So they agreed to do a few tracks with her. And Simon came to us and said, well, we've got Saeed Morton on board. We now want Sharp End on board. We want the full package. They were great pop records, GTO, you know, all of them. So, so we did the deal with Simon. But of course, hard to imagine now, but he pleaded your fees kind of out of reach for me. But Simon, you came to us. You want us on board. This is the deal. Anyway, we did a deal in the end. He said, well, I can't see you getting this played on Radio 1 because they didn't play the last one and it was a hit and they still didn't play it. So what we did, we went to Radio 1, by which time, as I say, because of the capacity, they were getting on board with pop. And we went to the head of music at Radio 1 and said, yeah, this sounded good. When's it out? You know, they won't commit to more than that, but it was a good reaction. So we went back to Simon and pay us on results. So he said, okay, £100 for every play you get on Radio 1. Okay. Well, he said, well, you won't get it played, so it'll be fine financially. Anyway, he got on the A-list at Radio 1, was getting whatever it was, you know, 50 plays a week. And we're sending invoices in to Simon for this money. He's going, in the end, let's have lunch. I can't deal with it. And it's your idea, Simon. Your problem. Anyway, we had a bit of fun over it and we compromised in the end.
Was that for Toy Boy?
Yes, it was that. After that, of course, it became easier with Sunita because, again, she handled herself very well and very TV friendly. Because I don't even know.
Hazel Dean, by the time I guess you would have been working with her, she had hits first time round with Still Cake and Autumn, and you came round for like the second album worth of hits. Were people receptive to Hazel Dean?
Not in the early days, because I think her record sold initially because she was the queen of high energy and she had that kind of following. It was about club support and her doing PAs, which was enough to get her records in the chart. But what happened was, who's leaving who? Pete said, we're not sure how this is going to go at Radio 1. So what can we do? So he said, how about we bring a couple of the key producers down and do a little bit of a tour of the studios. And then we take them in the studio, play them the record, and it will sound great. And then they will be fascinated by the whole setup here. And then we go to the pub. And that's exactly what we did. And these guys were completely blown away. Pete turned on the charm and we all went to the pub and the record went straight on the A-list at Radio 1. But it was a great record too.
1989, when Saw were very much honing in on that teen market, what was it like working with Sonia?
Yeah, well, she was great. I mean, just cheeky, scouser, just brilliant, you know, all round and something slightly different from Kylie or Hazel. And you warmed to her, great fun and no problem. No, never seemingly had an ego. Again, just a great crossover, high energy pop record. Sonia was brilliant. We did a Radio 1 road show with her in Southport, not far from Liverpool. And so her local fan base were all out on the beach. And the producer at that time, there was always this thing about maybe you would lip sync on the road show because you don't, the sound quality, open ear. But the producer convinced Sonia more than us that she should sing live. And she's wanted to prove that she could. So, yeah, I'd do it. By which time, the record was at number one anyway. And the reaction on the beach was fantastic. But the phone rings, the mobile, it's David Howells on the phone, and said, Mike is very, very upset. He said, you killed the record by letting her sing it live. I said, David, how many records have we sold at this point? And it was like 600,000, whatever it was. Yeah. So we've killed the record, haven't we? And he went, good point.
Now, speaking of Liverpool, did you work with the Reynolds girls?
Yeah, that was a weird one. Well, what I was saying earlier about Radio 1 being rock, Pete still had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, even when we'd had, with all those artists we've just been talking about, loads of Radio 1, he still felt he was getting shortchanged from Radio 1. That resulted in this record, but it was very much a one-off. There wasn't a lot going on, sadly, with those girls.
Well, there's all sorts of stories that they were difficult and or maybe not even them, but their dad possibly, who was looking after, was managing them, that there was difficult to deal with? Is that your memory?
A little bit. We never had a problem, but I do remember the dad, yeah, being married, and the mum, they would all go, because they were young, they were very young, so they needed that management, if you like. But the only annoying thing to us, they maybe meet in our office on our way to Radio 1 or something, and just sit there. Like, we've got a business to run here. Can't you go and have a coffee or something? And they would just sit in our office for, like, all day. So it was a little bit annoying, and they didn't really know what they were doing either. I don't think anyone at PWL would put up with it.
Also that year, Big Fun. What was the industry's reaction to Big Fun?
Okay, well, that was kind of the beginning, the whole boy band thing. So it was pretty good, because by then, not only Radio 1 doing the road shows, but Capital Radio had a lot of those kind of events. And Big Fun were just perfect for that, because to me, it was more about a dance routine than it was anything else. But I liked them, and they had a place, and that whole boy band thing, we could have hung on to that. They would have been the band, but it was possibly a bit too manufactured. They were Scott Aitken on record with three good-looking boys fronting it. But they were good. Good to work with, though. Good fun. Big fun.
So by that stage, going from 1989 into 1990, did you sense any resistance from the industry to Scott Aitken and Waterman? Because obviously, the success in 1989 was remarkable. All those number ones, all back-to-back hits. The situation in 1990 was very different. Did you get pushback from the industry? Oh, no, we're not going to play Stock Aitken Waterman anymore. Or what was the situation from your point of view?
Yeah, well, that did creep in. The whole, you know, the classic quote would be that all these records sound the same. You get that. But once we've broken through radio with all those records, we didn't find any resistance there, so it didn't really affect us too much. It was, I think, more the industry, as in other record companies, really, really saying, how could these guys, they're just lightweight pop records, and they've taken over the industry. So you've got the might of EMI, Warner, Sony. What are we doing? You know, and three guys can make all these great records, and we're not part of it. So basically, it was just jealousy that they could sell so many records. But they were selling more records than all the majors combined. So that was the backlash came from them. It wasn't really the media.
So things like in 1990, so we had Kakko, Romy and Jazz, Yell, Delage, Boy Crazy. Are they acts that you worked across? Are they all ringing bells?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Boy Crazy, I remember, American Girls. They were really, really good. And to this day, it's a mystery how it wasn't bigger than it was, because on paper, that all added up to huge success.
I'm just wondering if you noticed that it was becoming harder to, other than Kylie being the exception to the rule, it was becoming harder with what Stock Aitken Waterman were putting out in 1990 for it to go anywhere.
Yeah, everyone and everything has its time. So maybe it was just, when I say there wasn't a backlash, my memory of it all was we always got airplay pretty much on all those records. So from our point of view as pluggers, and indeed the press department did a pretty good job, you know, Boy Crazy got loads of press coverage because they look good. Again, on paper, that all added up to it should be successful. But maybe the public themselves got to a point where they thought, well, actually, all these records are starting to sound the same. And they would take that from Kylie and they'd take it from Jason. But for the newer artists coming through, I think maybe the public go, not as good as Kylie. It's okay. You know, so it basically ran its course. You can never really put your finger on why something. Like we always said, we all dread the post-mortem behind any campaign because, you know, we all do our best. And the guys, well, I thought, still make great records. We still got our, we did our job, but the public didn't go for it.
Mm.
sometimes you just never know why.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say that, because that's the era we're in right at the moment, and we are dealing with these songs that didn't do as well, and we're trying to account for why that might have been. So it's interesting to hear you say that they were still being played. And I have heard other people, like listeners, have said, oh yeah, I used to hear the Delage song Rock the Boat on the radio, and I could never understand why it wasn't a hit.
Yeah, it is a strange thing. But in the end, the public decide. The public were offered that opportunity to buy that record, and they declined. They decide. The public, in the end, they decide. I guess one of the problems later on became when Matt decided he wanted to leave, which was a sad day, because I think the chemistry, when it's three of them, is unbeatable and unstoppable. And once you break that, I don't think you ever get the same again. We used to say to Pete quite often, people get a bit carried away, so Pete, calm down. Are Matt and Mike happy? Are they okay? We're onto something here. Let's keep this going. Yeah, it's all fine, pal. It's all fine. And it wasn't fine, because in the end, when Matt left, that was the beginning of the end, really.
Were you surprised when he left?
Yeah, I was, but because we weren't really, we always had that worry. As I said, we say to Pete, keep the guys happy, bring them over the pub, because we're in the pub with whoever doing the PR, but they're in the studio all day and all night in a darkened room creating these great records. And I think Pete did his best to keep the harmony in there, and he did well for all those years. But again, all good things come to an end, I guess, you know, and Matt just decided he had enough.
And then obviously Mike left a couple of years later, and you worked with them both again at Love This as well.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it was a bit awkward that, because we were still obviously very close to David Howells and Pete, but all that was changing because Warners came in to buy the company, and we didn't know how long David was going to last. And eventually he was replaced, which was not good at all. So anyway, Matt and Mike tried to replicate the whole PWL setup. The studios and offices were close by in London Bridge. A really great studio, great offices, everything there. And they wanted to be a PWL. I mean, that was our observation, but they possibly wouldn't admit to that. but anyway, we got off to a flying start with Nicky French. So that was all fine. But we didn't know how Pete was going to react. We were working with guys. But he was actually sort of okay with it.
In terms of the PWL era, it was like the perfect marriage. They were great at making the pop records. You were great at getting them out there and getting them seen and heard and written about. So it is the perfect marriage of two companies.
Well, it was. It was kind of meant to be. It was just perfect harmony. It was great. And I think a lot of it was teamwork. And while Scott Ekman were the production and writing team, David Howells and his people were the record company and publishing team, and we were the promo PR team. But we all worked together in harmony, and it was a perfect situation. You know, right time, right place, right people. And I think the only thing that kind of rocked that boat, perhaps, would be Pete himself, to be honest with you, because Pete would, for example, we go in on a Monday morning, we've got 5-6 records in the top 10. It could be Sonia, Kyle, Jason, Big Fun, whatever they were. And he'd go, you know what, pal, I've got every record in the top 10. Pete, who are you talking about? We're in the business, we're in this with you. And you haven't got every record. So he had to kind of go that extra step that it was all me. So in other words, a little bit of that ego thing, he had to be basically good at everything, and he handled everything. David Howells ran the company, in my view, brilliantly. Great record man. But Pete would say, no, it's my company. I make all the decisions. I do, you know, I even do all the finance. I do everything. But that can cause friction. But anyway, having said all that, for most of that time, it was the perfect scenario.
Thank you, Ron, for sharing your memories of working with PWL. It's been interesting to explore the plugging, promotion and publicity side of things as another alternative perspective to the story that we've been telling.
Yeah, that was a really fascinating insight into another side of the business. It shows you the extent of the business and creative machine that was behind all those hits. So thank you, Ron.
And do check out Ron's book, In at the Sharp End, brackets, Stories from the Frontline of the Music Business. It's got some really great insight to his other work in the music industry. He was involved in a lot of stuff. And you'll hear more in the bonus material. You'll hear Ron talk about some more Saw artists, and he's going to talk about his memory of working with Kylie post-PWL, because Sharp End continued working with Kylie even if PWL didn't. So that's something for you Kylie stans to check out.
You could say he did it again, Gavin.
You could, if you were coming up with really...
Laboured puns, Gavin.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, Matt. Okay, we will be back soon. Yes, I know you've been waiting for us to get back on with the main point of this podcast. We will be back soon with the next standard episode. We are working on it. And until then, hassle us all you like on social media. I'm not on Twitter anymore. I have given up Twitter, so don't come for me there. Look for me at ChartBeatsAU on Instagram or Threads, and I'm also on Facebook, of course. And Matt, you're still hanging in on Twitter, aren't you?
I am on X, Gavin. I'm still hanging on by my fingernails on that platform. And you can also reach me on Thread. So please do hit me up. Send me a private message if you want to. I'd love to have a chat with you.
Excellent. All right. We will see you all after Matt gets back from his trip to the UK.
See everybody.
Bye.